Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blind Bargains Cast, episode 29. I'm Joe Steinkamp here with my good friend, JJ.
Oh, we're on now? Are we good now? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
good to be here. How's it going?
You don't like my announcer voice? It's you know, the boys of summer are putting away their bats. It's almost time for the feet ball. Feet ball.
It's an okay voice.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Yeah. You know, I actually introduced Jose Cruz once. That'll be a good thing for the. You remember the intro for Jose Cruz, the Houston Astros?
No.
Jose Cruz. That one.
Got to do that.
I got to do that. My brother at a Little League game, his opener, Jose threw out the first pitch, and I got to do that professionally, and I was very, very proud. Nice. Got to shake his hands afterwards. Lived a childhood moment. Oh, so, you know, the summer is now coming to an end, but that doesn't mean you can stop exercising. Exercising is the key, and you know what can help with that? Blind Alive.
Don't just live, be alive. Thank you so much for sponsoring us this week.
And also along the corner with that are the training friends over at Mystic Access.
Where the magic is in learning. And I love these slogans. Yes, the Victory Stream tutorial, of course. And you'll hear about these things a little bit later on. And thank you so much to our sponsors. Also coming up a little later on, Tim Elder. We've had a lot of talk about legal stuff, advocacy, and accessibility, disability advocacy. So we're bringing on Tim Elder, who is the principal attorney at TRE Legal, to talk all about that. So we'll have that up a little later in the show, as well as, is there another bacon story there in Last Word? Is there...
Bacon? We've never talked about bacon on this show
never.
Before, have we? Have
no.
Actually, there is something about bacon in Last Word. You are correct. It's a little bit of a take on a lot of feedback on the pumpkin spice peeps from last week. I was not shocked, but shocked at the veracity of which people had felt about pumpkin spice peeps. I actually did, when we were in Target, looked for some, but instead I found brownie batter Oreos, which are not that great, s'mores goldfish, which are as hideous as that sounds, and the brownie goldfish taste like Teddy Grahams. They taste like those chocolate Teddy Grahams. So I was looking for those.
Did you happen to also look for bacon?
That's not bacon. That's right. No, bacon. I can't read. That's an American ad, everybody. Sorry about that. That's what we're diverging from. Dogs like bacon, so I've been told by this ad. And dogs seem to like running. In fact, there seems to be a trend of people starting to run more with people who are visually impaired. So you have like a runner that runs with you. Maury Hill has talked about that on a show that I did once. And instead of having something distracting like a runner with you who you could have conversations with, you should just be running with maybe a canine because they got four paws and they like to run, right?
Why not? This is kind of cool. This is from Guiding Eyes over in New York. And while they generally will tell you if you're a guide dog owner or user that you should not be running with your guide dog, well, there's now an exception to this in the new pilot program that they have been working on, where they are training some specific guide dogs, this being the first, a dog named Clinger, to run with the owner. And lots of training that's been going into this, and they've paired him with a lieutenant out of San Francisco, Richard Hunter, who was in the Army, and wanted to do a lot of running, does marathons and things like that, but wanted to be a little more independent, as they put it. So this is a pilot program. They just graduated, and it's kind of one of those things. I guess we'll see how it goes, but that's an interesting application. Would a guide dog run an entire marathon?
Yeah, I wondered that too. And are there certain breeds of dogs that are better for running long distance, or you know, do you work the dog up for, you know, say a 4K, an 8K, and then along to a 23 mile or something?
The dog's doing the training with you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because you can't just take the dog, you know, take them straight from graduating. You got to kind of, and it also says something about pre-approved or not, that wasn't the exact word they used, but chosen or pre-chosen routes. So I'm not sure what that means. Or how that would apply to taking the dog on any random course. But, you know, nothing else, at least for workouts. If you want to do, say, like a 10-mile jog run around town and you're totally blind, your options are either find a guide runner do it on a treadmill, or wave your cane wildly and hope to God that you don't hit things.
No construction, no whammies.
These all work to varying degrees of effectiveness, depending on how you do things and your level of pain threshold. But
I was thinking about that. Who hits the runner's wall first? You or the animal? Or the other thought I had was, when working with an animal, I know some guides that want to be at the front of a pack when walking with other blind individuals. So imagine the desire of the dog to want to be first.
Oh man, I wonder. And then what if the dog met up with another dog? Would the other dog be inspired to start chasing after the?
Exactly. Oh, there's a cat. Well, wow, it's hard to run. I mean, direction.
I like to try to run, but if you try to, I think the fastest I'll get without a guide would be a nice brisk fast walk. I might run for short distances, but going down a street where you don't exactly know what's in front of you, it can be, it can be a bit.
In college, I did speed walking before it was an Olympic sport. In fact, I worked with one of the first coaches of Olympic speed walking. And did a lot of that. And I was okay at that. I'm no good at long distance running or running in general. It's not my favorite thing to do, but I was okay at speed walking. I had that down pretty much. And it is still very, you think, walking. No, there's a lot to it. And you have to walk a certain way. It's kind of a heel toe. Yep. And it's really challenging, actually. And you can build up a pretty good sweat. The only downside about it was I was doing it on college in a auditorium to kind of sort of get the basics down. So there was a lot of circles instead of being on a track where you've got a little bit of space before you have to make that left turn. This was a continuous left turn because I was going in our auditorium. And so it was kind of boring after a while. So there was a lot of audiobooks read on that particular college course. And it's interesting, but if you have experience with running or if you're interested in that, definitely check out the link in the show notes over at blindbargains.com or let us know in feedback what you think or if you have plans to do so.
That would be a really interesting thing to follow. Now, when you were in college, I might be off. Did they even, was it DOS? Or was it Windows 3.1?
I was doing a lot of Apple IIe, 2C stuff. Okay. There was just some really basic things. I had an IBM PC Junior at the house. I had a Commodore, although I was a bigger fan of Apple. I was using an Apple XE.
All right, okay. Windows 95 is 20 this week.
Excuse me, Atari XE. Yes, 20.
So this year way before that. And
I was there at the launch of Windows 95. I actually was at Incredible Universe for this launch of Windows 95. And two weeks from the record date 20 years ago. So if we go back 20 years ago and fast forward about 2 weeks, I was up to my neck in people returning copies of Windows 95 with disk 2 errors. For those of you who don't know that Windows 95 came on 50 floppy disks, and as you went to load them, it would say insert disk 2, and you would get to the end of disk 2 and it would go insert disk 1, and then you would insert disk 1 and it would go insert disk 2. There was a boot loop error, and
thank god that was on disk 2 and not disk 49.
Yes, that's exactly what we said at the time. There were a lot of people who brought in their computers, and we actually did that install on the
I'm sure that got old.
Yeah. Yes.
That's especially worth buying with the floppies, because
they're the most durable things in the world. And
that's a long way around
with the CD-ROM. One CD-ROM contains an operating system. Woo!
So much better. That's a long way around to say, well, happy birthday, Windows 95. 20 years later, Windows 10, and everyone trying to catch up to Windows 10. The latest being the Index embossers. We thought of the screen readers. We didn't really talk much about the others that are having to catch up, and sometimes we forget about things like your Braille embosser. These are the types of things that you have to definitely, if you use one of these things, when you upgrade to the latest Windows, does things like my Braille embosser or my flatbed scanner or whatever other specialized hardware work with Windows 10? When Index is not the latest to say yes, our stuff does. Free driver updates this week, including even the older V3 embossers, which I thought was cool that they're still supporting them. Those have been around since the early 2000s.
Well, if they're a good digital sign driver, they should port over fairly well, hopefully.
That is awesome. And that way you have some use out of that. It's a lot better than a lot of Windows boot camp users finding out that if their Macs aren't 2012 on up, they've got a really hard time upgrading. 2011 models are kind of sketchy on which ones can go to the latest version of Windows and which ones can't. Parallel users found out that they actually have to pay for upgrades in order to use the latest version of the Microsoft operating system. That's kind of a downside. And those of you who are hopping around right now trying to make that decision, the answer is still not if you don't need to. If you don't need to jump to Windows 10 right now, don't. Still hang out. As you heard, there are still updates coming from various companies and updates as they go. I am on one or two particular betas testing right now for support that's still yet to be announced out to the public. So we will see what happens. I was also kind of curious that, you know, would this work Windows 10 on my hotspot when I was in Orlando? And the answer to that was yes. Thank you, Verizon. I had no problems connecting my Surface to my Samsung Galaxy S5. But I understand from this article we have on blindbargains.com that some people did have some issues with connecting to the internets.
Especially in years past. Now, by this year, this became a non-issue because I think they had already gotten rid of the technology. So if you went to the NFB convention or another large convention, which happened to have like a huge convention center type setup, and you try to get online, a lot of times that's being run by some sort of third party company, in this case, Smart City. So Smart City wants you to buy their internet. So in an effort to do that, they kind of, interfered with the cell phone towers and blocked out everybody else's internet. That's not very legal. And they were just fined $750,000 by the FCC for doing that in several places, including the Orange County Convention Center in Orlando, where I can remember at least the first year that we were there in 2013 having a heck of a time trying to get online. And that certainly could have been part of the issue. You know how much they were trying to charge for their internet? $79.95 a day.
Oh,
what a deal.
Ouch.
For wireless, for one per computer, we maybe have three or four in the booth we want to get online, or just several devices that we want to demo. That's ridiculous.
I remember seeing several MiFis on the Discoverable list. It was like, you know, let me look around and see. Ooh, MiFi, AT&T, MiFi, AT&T. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
I had the AT guys booth D10 Wi-Fi on, and I took my phone to general session, and this didn't change the name of the network. So someone sends me a message. Wow, I could pick up your exhibit hall internet all the way from here. I'm like, yeah. No, actually, I brought my phone. That would be awesome, but that's not what happened.
Imagine if you stretched a row of dominoes all the way across, you know, that way to the exhibit hall is that one long elevated hallway.
It's a block.
That's just screaming for people to put dominoes up there and then tip them on over and make a great noise. Or in the exhibit hall, you could put a lot of dominoes in the exhibit hall.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, the little hallway, the long hallway is about a city block going from the hotel to the convention center. You know, probably easier to use a virtual dominoes. You can do that with the latest from Spoonbill. Ian from Australia, yet another or two more others in the entry of his long list of accessible games. A couple of different versions of dominoes that as anyone who's done this before, just need all you have to do is email him. I guess he likes to do that for tracking or whatever, but you just email him and ask him to send those to you, and he will send those to you. And I put his email again in there.
So you line up a bunch of iPods and iPhones that form as dominoes. Is that? No, that doesn't work that way, does it? Okay.
No, you can line up pizza boxes too. I think the dominoes pizza boxes should be made of dominoes. Or maybe dominoes should do a dominoes pizza.
You could use Google cardboard with dominoes pizza boxes. You know, the famous Google cardboard. That was a joke that turned into a real thing. Google cardboard is used by a lot of people for virtual reality. And, you know, some people say that numbers on the App Store and on the Google Play Store are sometimes virtualized, right? That couldn't possibly be a billion, a Carl Sagan billion. No. Well, it seems like TalkBack has reached the billion club in downloads. This came from Android Central. and got it from Nimer. I thought this was kind of neat to think. Now, along with that, I've got a related story that says that Google is unbundling some things like Google Play and Google Newsstand, or Google Games, like Google Play, you know, like the Google Play Games and Newsstand, because some people felt like those were artificially inflated numbers. You know, people might not have grabbed Play Games or the iOS equivalent of Game Center, the Android equivalent of Game Center for iOS. So, you know, when you say that you have a billion, is it really that many people? Because would they have independently downloaded it?
No.
Well, Google seems to be uncoupling things back and forth. Maybe that's also under the fear of EU going after them for antitrust. But I still think this is a monumental achievement that there is a billion uses of a screen reader installed copies on the world's most popular operating system.
How many? I mean, you do need to put this in a little bit of perspective. A billion is amazing. I am probably not your typical Android user, but I can, let's see, I've gone through two Nexuses, four different phones, not counting anything that I've used for testing. I've had Android for about 4 years, so anyone who goes through phones every couple of years, so I have it on at least six different devices, of course, four of which I haven't really used lately. But, you know, it's monumental that, you know, this wouldn't have happened, of course, if it wasn't a default part of the, you know, the operating system, and it wasn't always. And, you know, a billion is a lot. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. It's a built-in thing. And it's easy to just make the argument that, yeah, that's just a built-in component. So everyone's just getting it because of auto updates. But there are other Google apps, including the ones that you mentioned, which haven't hit a billion and have been pretty much been around for as long. So somebody's turning those off and they're like, TalkBack, oh, whatever. You can just stay here. Although it's funny to read the reviews sometimes of people complaining about TalkBack that have no idea what it's supposed to do.
It won't read my emails. I don't understand.
It's like, I can't get this phone to turn off. All it's doing is talking. If I touch it, it won't. Yeah, because that's how it works.
It's the same way about reading emails and stuff with Apple's built-in voiceover. When the cited press or mainstream press writes about voiceover, it's kind of funny to read sometimes. But I wish it would just tap. I wish I could put my finger on it. It would just do things, not understanding layering and, you know, gesture support and things like that when it comes to voiceover. It's weird to think. I saw that article that came out from The Verge and others that said that 96.8% of all smart devices were Android or iOS.
Yep.
That, and I believe the market track for Windows Phone was 2.4, down from 2.9.
I appreciate you sending that over, because I was able to spout that stat off to a customer today when they called and they're asking about Havens.
Yeah, it is really crazy to think. Hopefully, Microsoft is thinking that Windows 10 might turn the tide, and they're certainly going to be some things that are happening. The Windows Mobile 10 preview is still going on even as we speak. That's supposed to be out later this year. And there's a lot of new handsets coming in the world of Windows. We often get emails asking us about what we feel about Narrator on Windows Phone, or why don't we cover Narrator on Windows Phone, or why is Joe down on Narrator on Windows Phone, which actually was a couple of months ago. 2.4% is kind of why. There are very few instances of Windows Phone being used in the corporate environment, and those who do have reported some real interesting things. But Windows Phone has had more changes in the last 3 years to its operating system, file system, and its accessibility that I just choose not to keep up with it because of the other.
You just can't. I mean, and forget corporate, look at mainstream. Whenever you hear apps that are released, you know, it's, you know, download it today on your iPhone or Android. It's like, Windows Phone, it's hardly ever. And companies have to beg app developers to make a Windows Phone version of their app. Microsoft has to beg.
And this is another one of those things when people come up to me and say, I want to get into podcasting, or I want to be a trainer, or I want to do what you guys do, and I want to be really good at it. What should I do? You look at something that's underserved in our community. And if you want to be the best Windows person using blank, or the best Windows mobile user using Narrator, or maybe you're the best Apple trainer using Office 2016 Excel. That's awesome. Then you become the subject matter expert in that area. And that's what Jay and I did for years. We ran out there and played with stuff. where others feared to tread, and that's how we got that experience. So if you find that you want to go after one of these platforms, go get it, and then come back and tell us about it, because then that's how you show up on our radar, is you are, you know, the killer expert in that particular area. So that's just kind of a tip.
Yeah, I like it. One of you could go out and play with, so what is this? This is, it's called Aftersight?
Aftersight. It came from the Seeing with Sound Twitter feed, which you might know as The Voice, who we've interviewed before years ago. Yeah. And it's using a Raspberry Pi with a couple of sensors on it. So it seems like an extra version of The Voice. I mean, it seems like smart glasses.
Yeah,
it's looking still to be crowdfunded. So you've got all the good typical things that we've had in a lot of these stories over the last couple of weeks. Crowdfunded. All right. Tick. Raspberry Pi. All right. Right. Okay. Economies of scale. I like that right there on the website. That's a phrase that's used often. It bears all the fruits of all the things we hear in the, I have an idea, I want to bring it to market, blank fill in moments. You know what I'm saying? It just, I don't know if this is going anywhere, but it's certainly on the list of sensory substitution devices that we seem to be getting a lot of lately this year. Somebody has a better mousetrap for how to bring us information in a visual world. So I thought I'd bring it up on the radar and see what people thought.
The thing I like about the developer of the VOIC on this, Peter Mayer, you know, not everything that he has done will necessarily be, you know, sticky. It won't, like, it hasn't mainstream, like, it won't always catch on. It's a lot of it's way out there stuff, but he is not afraid to dream and try new things. And, you know, something might stick in the future. And you need people like that, that are kind of out there technologically and trying some different things to see what might be the next wave of something. And, you know, when you have people that are kind of just kind of, you know, iterating on the current, it doesn't help us a lot with the future. So I definitely always look forward to seeing what type of things that he comes up with.
I think of Anna when she first used that and talked about it on the podcast years ago. She was not convinced. And then over time, she grew to understand how the software worked because it was different. It was not a typical paradigm that you're used to using in the way that you had with older technology. That's, again, one of those things where maybe somebody has the right idea and just has to be the beacon that shows the rest of us, hey, no, that's awesome, and we could use it. And, you know, that's why crowdfunding is mentioned a lot here, is that it does find those tastemakers to turn other people onto the technology and then go do other crowdfunding, like this next story.
Let's go back to crowdfunding and crowdsourcing. Here we go again with crowdsourcing outcomes, this time using iCare. You know how we talked about, we've been talking about Braille before and how it's hard to find Braille instructors in remote areas. Well, sometimes it's hard to find eye doctors in remote areas as well. And this is an app and a system designed to get some data to doctors and to help people diagnose conditions and do a lot of that for people who may otherwise not have access to healthcare locally, especially if you're in a developing country, or even if, say, if you're in like rural Montana and the nearest McDonald's is 150 miles away, well, the nearest eye doctor is probably much further than that. And if you don't have transportation, or just, you know, you just don't have a way of getting anywhere closer, remote medical assistance, I think, done the right way with qualified people, certainly has a lot of potential as more of this technology, you know, ends up in your phone. So this, I think, is another one I think that we should be watching out for.
One of the things that we've gotten a lot of feedback on are people asking us questions about how vision works, or how does someone approach one particular situation or another. These last stories here that I put at the bottom of the news feed are kind of to answer some of those questions, because we see them a lot on Twitter, or people ask us on or offline. The first one, with kids going back to school, I thought was really fascinating. This is more, you know, schools are using eyeballs instead of IDs for unlocking things or getting power to things. Biometrics. And so a lot of retina scanning, which, you know, for someone with, say, double prosthetics, a little different. Not that the devices couldn't be taught or learned how to do that. But in a lot of cases, I just ran into this recently with Ricky. You know, her son's going back to school, and the assumption that you would get the information from a whiteboard, just take your camera up there and take a picture of it, and there you go. You know, it's that's the information. I passed it along to you. Or Chromebooks, a lot of Chromebooks in this particular school system. And that is an interesting thing to see, because we often talk about what we hear about in the mainstream or what we've read online, but then to run right into it in a situation like this where people are thinking, yeah, you know, eyeball, retina, what could go wrong? Everybody's got eyes. Yeah. Also, along with that, there's a couple of other articles here to go along with it about why people see faces in things, why people look into each other's pupils in order to gain trust, and then how seasons can actually affect people's vision in color. So all perceptual vision color-related objects here that I thought might be good for people to read in order to have an idea of why sometimes they hear their friends or family say one thing or another about what they're seeing. But, you know, as you said, Jay, schools are back in session. A lot of kids walking around with those big, heavy backpacks full of Chromebooks and heading off to the bus. Probably going to be really weighty. Wish there was another way of being able to carry things around with you.
You know, yeah, you really owe it to yourself to check out the back tape pack. And I know this from carrying around a backpack for many, many years. And, you know, it's taken a bit of a toll on my shoulders. I'm really trying now to catch up and watch out for that and really take care of my health, and you should be doing the same too. So if you're a person on the move, you owe it to yourself to check out the back tee pack. You know, don't load everything directly. Your spine is not a shelf, and you really can evenly distribute the weight evenly. There's two packs that are really roomy that you can distribute the weight and put all your techie stuff, or whatever you're carrying around, your books, your Chromebooks, all your cables and wires and whatnot. Whether you're a student or a teacher, of course, you're going back to school. It makes a lot of sense, as you said, Joe, if you have books and school supplies. If you're a traveler, you can organize and carry many, many items for a long weekend away. You know, many airlines now, you actually have to pay to bring some larger bags on. But if you put it in a backpack, you can put it under the seat in front of you. And then even if you fly one of the no-frills airlines, you can put the back tee pack and just kind of drop it in front of you. If you're a techie, like I said, the roomy pockets, you know, headphone ports, the secure design, which virtually eliminates theft. If you want to check out the workouts of Blind Alive, www.blindalive.com. Again, www.blindalive.com. There's links there to the back tee pack that you can order. Or you can check out the show notes, of course, at blindbargains.com. We'll link to the website. We'll link to the page for the back tee pack, one of the coolest little gadgets. You know, it is a gadget, even though it's a backpack, but one of the coolest gadgets in your tech arsenal.
Yeah, they just celebrated 1 year of podcasting, I believe, over there at Blind Alive. So congratulations to those guys over there. And have you seen the new Camp Cutthroat, the Cutthroat Kitchen special that's going around where they're actually at camp and recording in the outdoors? It's really cute. There's a lot of people out there having to cook. And if you're not familiar with it, here in America, there's a channel called Food Network, and they do this thing, which is a food competition show. But during it, you can actually have the chefs bid against sabotages against one another. And one of the sabotages recently was for a chef to wear this oversized backpack during the competition for that dish. Nice. And it was overly weighted, and they tried to bend over and fell over. And I kept thinking of the back tee pack the whole time. Was like, you know, there's a perfect example of what doesn't work very well. But of course, you know, that's just one of those things that I think of when I'm watching television. And not too far away is my thoughts about what is available here on the show and what's coming up next. Bacon. See how I came back around, yes, to that? Bacon. So much more to talk about, plus our interview with Tim, all coming up here after the break.
Mystic Access is pleased to introduce our comprehensive audio tutorial on the HumanWare New Generation Victor Reader Stream. This tutorial is a fully navigable DAISY 3 book and is over 8 hours and 10 minutes in duration. Learn to successfully navigate within each offline and online bookshelf. Configure your Wi-Fi connection. Discover how to use the Bard and Bookshare functionality. Find out how to transfer content, use bookmarks, set sleep timers, and so much more. Each bookshelf is thoroughly covered within its own section so that you can easily and intuitively find the material which most interests you. In addition to our tutorial on the stream, Mystic Access also has an ever-increasing line of comprehensive tutorials ranging from topics such as Sendero maps and sense navigation to voiceover internet protocol services. Mystic Access looks forward to empowering you in using your assistive technology efficiently while having fun doing it. Please visit today at www.mysticaccess.com, where the magic is in learning.
Welcome back, episode number 21 of the BBcast for the middle of August, end of August 2015. And we've had a lot of talk pretty much since the beginning of our shows about various legal issues. And sometimes we try to talk intelligibly about them, but often, you know, well, we're not the legal experts around here, but we brought in someone who is, and someone I've known for a long time, Tim Elder, who is the principal attorney at TRE Legal, is joining us on the podcast to talk everything legal. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here. I am a longtime listener and fan of the podcast. So, you know, you guys help us, the lawyers, sort of stay in touch with sort of what's going on in tech and stay informed. So I definitely enjoy the show and other versions of, you know, this podcast. It helps us sort of stay on top of everything.
Well, we do appreciate that a lot, and thank you so much for listening. So you run your own law firm and actually are the principal attorney. Tell us a little bit about what you do in general, and then we'll get into some of the specific issues surrounding disability rights.
Yeah, sure. So, I started out at a larger firm called Brown, Goldstein & Levy, and this is a firm out in Baltimore that does a lot of the NFB's major litigation, major legal advocacy. So I sort of built my chops out there at that firm and then spun off my own practice and am sort of still doing some of the same work. I'm doing, you know, a good amount of work with NFB still, but I'm also doing, you know, other cases, things on my own. The TRE Legal practice is a law firm that really specializes in civil rights of people with disabilities, with particular focus on issues around blindness, a lot of cutting edge sort of legal issues around technology, the ADA, access to information. I mean, that's really what we're talking about, is the legal right to gain equality through access to digital content.
You mentioned the ADA specifically, and of course, a lot of these legal issues are around either modern laws or laws that necessarily were written in a time where computers and modern technology wasn't even imagined or developed them. That must make things a little more difficult. It's not always a cut and dry solution, or at least, I mean, of course, we always try to think that we're right when it comes to this stuff, but, you know, so a lot of times the laws aren't even there.
It's a challenge, right? Because we've got a statute that, you know, we just celebrated its 25th anniversary, and we're trying to take what Congress intended back in, you know, 1990, and decipher what does that mean in the context of modern society with all of the digital enhancements that we now have. Yeah, I mean, certainly some people take a very conservative view that, well, the ADA only applies to, you know, these several things listed in the statute. It doesn't mention websites. It doesn't mention anything else. So Congress didn't intend for that to be the case. However, there is language in the ADA and in some of the prefatory provisions that says Congress intended that the ADA would evolve and adapt to grow along with technology. So we do have some pretty solid, you know, ground to say that Congress intended the ADA to keep pace with modern technology. You know, of course, you know, any defendant company that's trying to, like, escape the requirements under the ADA is going to argue the opposite. But, you know, Congress anticipated that this would happen, at least to some extent, right? They knew that technology would change, and they wanted the ADA to change with it.
And if you look at history as far as the ADA and how it's been applied to various cases over the years, more often than not, the rights of people with disabilities have won over those over others, right?
Yeah, it has generally evolved in a positive direction. You know, we've got cases that have been helpful in interpreting it. You know, there's the Target.com case, which was really sort of the seminal case, or one of the bigger cases that established that a website was covered by the ADA and state law. I mean, there's some others as well, but for the most part, the law is trying to keep up with the technology, but it's not a perfect system, right? Like, I mean, in Congress, you know, only updates the ADA every decade or so, right? So yeah. There's no way Congress right. will keep up with it. So just getting the courts to keep up with the technology, right? Now you've got the sharing economy, right? And you've got people with mobile devices and accessing content, not just at their home, but in the place of public accommodation, right? So you've got all of these very interesting changes to technology, and you know, the courts trying to keep up.
Well, let's talk about some of these issues. You mentioned the sharing economy, which of course started out with a lot of it with ride sharing, Uber and Lyft and Sidecar, but now has expanded to other things. You can share your house, you can share, you know, your vehicle, you can share chores. There's so many different ways that this is being applied now. And, you know, things that hadn't been anticipated or even thought about in the past several years. And some of this stuff isn't very accessible.
Yeah, I mean, it is a challenge. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, at least my practice is really looking very closely at the sharing economy and establishing, you know, sort of the legal precedents now so that as these companies are building their platforms, because, you know, many of them are still in flux, right? Like they're growing, they're still working things out. And so we're trying to get their attention now and say, hey, you know, you've got this cool idea that's, you know, has great potential for blind people. Make sure you're building in accessibility and thinking about ADA requirements now so that it will be much better for you to build it into the design from the beginning and from the preliminary stages rather than waiting, you know, 5 years, 10 years, and then having to go back and figure out how do we take this and retrofit it for people with disabilities? And that's true for both digital accessibility and for mm-hmm. sort of more traditional right access, right? Like when you're building your sharing system, like what kind of policies are you using, that sort of
sure.
thing.
So what type of approach are you going to take? You take a company like an Uber or a Lyft, when you find out that an app or a website is not accessible, and asking you or perhaps you working with an organization like the NFB, a lot of times there's the assumption that on day one that there, you know, this is going to be a lawsuit and that's how we're going to solve all these problems. But what's the more like type of approach that you might take for trying to resolve an issue like this?
So what I'm going to say may surprise a lot of people, but the legal system is actually the worst avenue to try to resolve a dispute. I mean, it's incredibly expensive. It takes a long time. Ultimately, you know, if it goes to litigation, someone's being forced to do something they may not want to do. And it is not an ideal place to resolve a problem. Sometimes, you know, it's the last resort, so we have to do that. And sometimes it's a necessary, you know, it's sort of a necessary evil to send a message into the industry and, you know, get everyone in line. But at least my practice, we always start with trying to resolve it amicably with a company. We're not trying to play gotcha or, oh, hey, you violated the ADA, we're gonna nail you now. We want these companies to benefit from a larger customer base, including, you know, the large number of customers that are blind and are now walking around with awesome accessible mobile devices. So it always starts with, hey, will you sit down and talk with us? You've got this problem. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the companies, and this is a part that a lot of people never see, is like a lot of these disputes get resolved. No lawsuits ever filed. The company makes its stuff accessible. And, you know, it's a happy ending. And unfortunately, a lot of times it doesn't get press or that doesn't sell.
Yeah, or it just gets buried somewhere. You might hear
Yeah, or it's buried, briefly, right? I'll give you an example. We negotiated an agreement with Square, right? The mobile payment company.
Yeah.
And then even in Sidecar around the accessibility of their apps. And both of those companies, like, really sort of like once the issue was brought to their attention, they like totally got on board and wanted to fix it, right? Like, we have a great relationship now, I think, with the you know, the folks at Square and some of these other companies. And today, I still hear from them, right? Like, it could have resulted in litigation, right? But instead, it's turned into a really positive thing. And those companies still ask questions like, hey, we're trying to do this kind of program on accessibility. What do you think? And so I'll send them, you know, a list of resources or the name of, you know, an iOS accessibility consultant or something. And, you know, they generally embrace it. It's only some, you know, sometimes the bad ones that say, like, look, we don't think we have to do this. We'd rather risk fighting you in court than just do the right thing for our customers. And it happens, but it tends to be more rare, I'd say.
You know, sometimes it seems like you might get mixed messages from even the same company, where you'll have someone in the company or a few people that are going to say, oh, I really would love to do a lot for accessibility. But then a lot of times it seems like the problem is just getting to the right person or trying to get the message really aggregated appropriately.
Yeah, you know, a lot of companies right now, too, are really good about sort of setting gatekeepers out so that, you know, they're set up to receive all kinds of support tickets and, like, general customer concerns. But, like, trying to get a company to sort of change its culture or its design, that often doesn't ever make, you know, by sending a message, you know, just, like, through support or an email channel or even on Twitter, that often doesn't get the attention of the right people, you know, at the head of the company that, you know, have the authority to really sort of start turning the boat around. Usually, you know, a letter from a lawyer tends to get to float up to the top.
Yeah.
But, you know, self-advocacy is good, but at the same time, I fear that a lot of companies are sort of intentionally trying to filter out some of that content through their, you know, support channels.
So I know there's been a lot of talk about the ride sharing and a lot of been going on with that recently. There was focus groups for Uber and Lyft at the NFB convention in Orlando, and a lot of discussions recently. Of course, the guide dog issues have been lingering among that and some of the app issues, especially on Uber, but a little bit on Lyft as well. Any news on that front or anything that we can talk about?
Yeah. I mean, I have to be careful because, right, I'm the attorney on the service animal case, so I have limitations on what I can say. And we are engaged in mediation, right? And this is public knowledge, right? That we are right. Talking with them, trying to settle the case, right? Because, you know, this is about a quality of service for Uber's customers, right? And I think we have mutual end games, which is to make sure that the Uber experience is consistent for all passengers. So, you know, I'm hopeful that this will be a productive sort of mediation going forward. But it's interesting that it's even come this far.
You hear a lot of different things, you know, different states or, you know, Uber says the right things when you approach their PR people as far as, you know, yeah, we don't, you know, of course, we have a very strict policy on service animals. And then, of course, you still hear stories every so often about it as well. So you're right. It's very mixed.
Yeah. And, you know, and Uber definitely has like a PR sort of angle, right? And to some extent, that's been its approach for a lot of different issues, right? It's kind of got this dual prong, like litigation plus PR. Like even in the independent contractor class action, right? That trying to say that the drivers are employees. You know, the lawyer was out there having a big press conference with a bunch of drivers who were, you know, reading their statements and saying how they loved it and they, you know, they wanted to be independent contractors, right? And so I think that is consistent, right? Uber has put out PR for a lot of these litigation issues, right? You know, and I think you guys even had, you know, talked about one last week on your show, right, with the Matt Simpson and the goal ball and everything. Right,
exactly. Yeah, they're,
you know, so, you know, it's fine. That's their approach. But and I will say that Uber has the potential to be extremely awesome for blind people. I mean, it really does have the power to promote independence and be affordable and provide an option that in many cases is far superior to a traditional taxi cab. You know, and that's part of the reason why this litigation is out there, right? Like, we recognize that this service is so critical for blind people, and we just want to make sure that, you know, whether you're using a cane or a guide dog, the experience is consistent. I think it's a win-win for everyone, Uber and the blindness service animal community.
Is your litigation specifically focused on the service dog issues as opposed to app accessibility, or is that
the litigation is narrowly focused on service animal passengers, policies and practices around passengers who use service animals. It does involve app accessibility to the very limited extent it involves filing a complaint, you know, because a driver, you know, rejected you because you have a service animal.
Right. Sure. That makes sense.
So, but you know, others are working on the accessibility piece, right? Like NFB National, right, is talking with them about this, I believe, and different states are imposing requirements for app accessibility. California has an explicit requirement that the apps have to be accessible. So to some extent, that issue is being addressed. Whether you know Uber or others are actually compliant to those standards right now, I don't know, right? Because the apps, the accessibility of all of the TNC apps has sort of fluctuated from version to version.
Well, right. And I think that was one of the big issues in the past, especially when, you know, new features would get rolled out and suddenly, you know, it ends up being a quality of life issue when you go to open your app and request a ride and suddenly you can't get a ride anymore. I mean, that you were counting on. It's, you know, it's a big thing.
Yeah, no, it's a huge thing. And in some cases, like they were pushing updates, right? So they say like you can no longer use the service unless you agree to upgrade to the next version of the app, which it's pretty aggressive.
So you do a lot with mobile apps and technology. Any other apps specifically or modern websites that you're looking at these days?
Well, you know, there's a lot of inaccessible apps out there.
Where do we start?
And website. So I have, you know, a hit list, I guess, of like things I'm looking at, you know, things people have complained about, you know, and I try to stay in touch with the community. Like what are a lot of people having problems with? Like, you know, for example, like I heard last week on your show, right? Like Joe mentioned the Panera Bread app, right? So I put it on my list. Mm-hmm. I got to take a look at this app. And, you know, there's others as well. There's other sharing economy apps. That
Airbnb has come up a few times.
Yes. Yeah, that's on, you know, I have received a number of complaints about that, and it's pretty high up on the list. So, you know, these are things that we'll keep working on going forward. I mean, the goal is like, okay, like, let's hope the developer says, okay, I get it. This is important. We'll change our ways. But, you know, then again, some of these sort of new startup companies get pretty arrogant and say like, well, you know, we don't have to comply with that. That's not something that applies to developers, right? That's actually not true, right? I think we've got this weird like situation going on where like software developers, right, who used to make products and are in the mindset of like, I don't have to build in accessibility because I just make a product, right? Like the ADA doesn't cover products. Well, now, instead of offering products, they're offering services. And services do have certain requirements under the ADA and even and more so under some state laws that have broader protection than the ADA, right? So Massachusetts, maybe, you know, a few other states arguably cover a lot more than the ADA and that you don't have to have like the physical location. Like Netflix, right, was required to make certain accommodations for captioning under Massachusetts law, and I think even under the ADA as well in that circuit. So you may not be able to bring a case like that in every state in the country. You wouldn't want to bring it in every state in the country, but there are places where the law is a little bit more established.
Where is the line when it comes to whose responsibility it is? For instance, you have some apps for Windows, call center type apps come up, some of the Microsoft SharePoint type, those type of things. They can be made accessible if you were to purchase expensive scripts or other technologies, but they wouldn't be accessible out of the box. Is that the type of thing? Does that still, to you, look at as a violation of ADA that you have to do extra accommodations to make something like that accessible, or is that good enough?
Well, I guess it depends on the context, right? Because there's, you know, the public accommodations context where a business is offering a service to the public to come in and consume. And then there's another context, which is employment. I am actively doing a lot of work in the employment sector because you've got these big enterprise systems like what you just described, right? SharePoint, Oracle, you know, big enterprise systems like that that are not being developed with accessibility in mind. And so you get a blind employee, right? Like, it's trying to go into a call center. Like, we have an active case right now against Marriott and then some other, you know, other companies, right? So some blind employee wants to get hired and get a job. And then there's this question that comes up, okay, now the software doesn't work with JAWS directly out of the box. So in that case, if the employer did not take the time and bother looking at the accessibility of the product before it purchased it, right? Because there are a lot of these products, you know, have VPATs or the employer could have, when it purchased or it did the install, they could have said, okay, is this compliant, right? Because most of this stuff is delivered through a browser now, right? Is it WCAG compliant? Is it generally accessible? Does it meet the Section 508 guidelines? If you're an employer and you don't look at that stuff when you're buying your enterprise software, you don't have to. But then if you get a blind employee who's qualified and you need to hire them, you can't then just turn them away because the software doesn't work. You have to provide reasonable accommodations to make that software work. And if that means hiring a JavaScripter to do, $50,000 worth of JavaScripting work, and then maintain it, over the career of the software, that's the price of business. And you are required to do that as an employer under the ADA, unless you can show it's an undue burden, right? But $50,000 for a lot of these big companies is nothing, right? And I will say, the number one thing, sort of myth that I'd like to bust that I hear a lot of employees sort of say is like, oh, well, $50,000, wow, that's a lot of money. Like, I'm going to be making, minimum wage or something. There's no way this employer or this like department of the employer is going to fork over that kind of money for my kind of job. And that's so not the right analysis. You don't look at the cost of the accommodation in comparison to the salary of the employee or the overall, value of the employee's contribution to the company. You look at the price of the accommodation as compared to the overall assets and revenue and resources of the company. So, for Marriott, right? $50,000. Right, for JavaScripting, right? For someone who's, making, $15 an hour or something, that's what the law requires. And then you're getting into other issues about, well, are human readers sufficient, right? Which, in most cases, like if you're using a software program from daily, having a human
assistant, you'd be paying more on the reader eventually, than $50,000 eventually. Your costs are gonna be way high.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Or the access is going to be inferior, right? Which is probably more the case. Like you're going to have limited access to that human reader.
The readers can't read as fast as that too. There's a lot of it. Now, it brings up an interesting point, though, when you're talking about, say, call center software. Mm-hmm. And a company like Marriott can afford to make those accommodations. At some point, it's really the responsibility of the call center software vendor, though, to make sure. I mean, if I wanted to work for a company of 20 people that was using that same software, they're not going to be able to afford that kind of accommodation at all. But really, the software should have been accessible in the first place. So do you find it easier to, for lack of a better term, go after a company like Marriott versus the vendor that creates software like this?
In some respect, that's the way the law sort of puts it out. Like, I can't, under the ADA, I can't go after Oracle, right? Because they're not covered by the law. The best I can do is go after the employers of Oracle who are their customers, right? And then apply demand for accessibility on their customers in hopes that, enough customers will say, hey, we have a lawsuit because your stuff is not accessible. What are you going to do about that? And that then in turn changes what Oracle does, because it's hearing from its larger customers. Unless you're going after the government, right? Mm. I mean, it's kind of the same thing, right? Where you're saying, well, you shouldn't buy inaccessible stuff, but you can't go after the vendor. You have to go after the government agency that purchased, used, or maintained the inaccessible technology. So this is like a huge issue for blind people in employment right now, is the accessibility of this software. And
So many of the jobs that should be accessible to blind people are not, and it's technology holding it back. It's not the skills of the blind people holding it back at all.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true, and it's almost becoming like a zero-sum game, right? Because the software could, right, if it was designed accessibly, could open up a lot of opportunities for blind employees to do a large number of jobs. In some cases, make them. If it was really accessible and you built in some of the efficiencies, it would make blind people even more competitive than other UI users, like people using a mouse or something. So there's a lot of opportunity. The problem is that opportunity is not being realized, because they're using UI design that's precluding screen reader access.
There's a lot of things that we could go on for hours about all this. So we'll definitely have to have you back on sometime to talk about a lot more of this. But I'll close with this. You've talked about people having challenges with apps or with certain, whether it's apps or websites or software or whatever. How should they let you know about these challenges? And what's the, like, what information are you looking for from people? What are the types of tips that would help you out?
It'd be good to hear from the community, right? Like, if you are experiencing an inaccessible website or an app or whatever, right? Touchscreen in a place of public accommodation, because it's another area that we've done a lot of work on in. You know, just drop me an email, find me on Twitter, because it's good for me and the other lawyers, you know, the network of lawyers that I work with, to know, like, what are the priorities, right? Like, I look at the Apple, you know, this site from time to time to see, like, okay, what apps are really popular and, like, what are the priority items for the community, right? So it's good for me to hear from folks, because that kind of in some ways dictates, you know, sort of what we look at when we're doing legal enforcement or, you know, trying to work with these companies. But folks can send me an email. My email address is telder, as in elder, not younger, at trelegal.com. It's Tango Romeo Echo Legal.com. You can find me on Twitter as well. I'm at trelegal. If you go to my website, you can find me through any of these channels, which is just trelegal.com.
And when Tim is not doing legal stuff, we played together a little bit. That was fun in Orlando. The 75th anniversary band choir, what do you call it, over at the convention in Orlando. That was a lot of fun.
We did, yeah. No, JJ, for those who don't know, is a pretty rocking piano player, keyboardist. Has perfect pitch too, which is something I've very
useful and annoying.
Yeah, and then I play electric bass guitar. Yep. And so we were jamming. It was fun, right? Like, I'm a lawyer, and I'm mostly known for, you know, doing lawyerly things within the blindness community. So it was fun to sort of break out of that and sort of rock the electric bass a little bit. It's good times.
We'll link to some of that as it comes out. Some pretty cool stuff that came out of that. So lots of fun to work with you on a different level. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, and keep up the good work, too. This podcast is such a valuable resource for the community. I mean, it, you know, ensures that, you know, at least one of the lawyers, right, is paying attention and kind of keeping an eye on what's going on in the tech field. But, I mean, I think it's such a great resource for especially folks who are, like, newly blinded and are just trying to figure this whole thing out. Like, this podcast is such an excellent source to just sort of orient them, like, okay, where should I be looking for more information about technology and what should I know about and where can I find more? I mean, I encounter a lot of people who are calling my office and they don't even know where to begin on this sort of journey of dealing with blindness or kind of trying to figure this whole thing out. So you guys offer a really valuable service. So anything I can do to support it, I'd love to come back. Consider me your, you know, outstanding legal correspondent for Blind Bargains.
We'll have to give you one of those titles like they have on CNN. You know, Blind Bargains resident legal correspondent.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tim. Thanks for the nice words and thanks for coming on the show.
Sure. Thank you.
Coming up, yes, Joe's story about bacon. I don't even know what that's about, but I'm not surprised. There's a bacon story and much more in Sound Off. But first, a tip.
A simple iOS tip is one that I came a little late to the party on. People like Aaron Edgar and Ricky Enger taught me this one, and I use it a lot on things like the iOS Twitter app. And what I'm talking about is sometimes you're down deep in a menu, or sometimes you're on, let's say, Twitter, you're way down in your timeline, and you don't want to do three-finger swipes to go all the way back to one of 640. So a good way to get up to the very tippy top is to go up and put your finger on your clock.
3:49 p.m. Status bar item.
Tap it.
Rows 1 to 5 of 399.
And that'll send you to the very top of your column. So when you're really far down in something, settings or on Twitter or anything that has a very, very long list of things, tapping your clock will jump you up to the very tippy top. So put your finger on the clock, tap it, and then go to the very top. It's a simple tip that I came a little late to the party to, but I use it a lot now, almost just about every day. And I kind of sort of wish I had something like that for Android. Maybe there is one, and I just don't know about it. If you do, or if you have some other ideas about tips, send them on in to the information you're about to hear right before Sound Off.
It's your turn to sound off. Email feedback at blindbargains.com or tweet us at blindbargains.
Well, we got in a lot of feedback, of course, with the end of our promotion for Jet. We got a couple of more comments in on episode 27. So we'll put away the emails this week for next week. And we'll focus mostly on some of these great comments that you guys left over at blindbargains.com. Just because the promotion has ended doesn't mean that you don't have to comment. You can actually leave us information at any of the ways that you just heard a moment ago. And we love to hear your feedback. And as you heard, it directly impacts what we do on this show. Coming up first is Abraham. And he told us that he loves the show. Thank you. Appreciate that. He also recommends that we try the peanut butter M&M sandwiches. Now, I've not tried.
What?
I've had peanut butter M&Ms.
Oh, yeah.
And I've had different things. They did do ice cream sandwiches where it was like the peanut butter M&Ms and a cookie around ice cream. Kind of like the old 7-Eleven Big Wheels. Big Wheels. But I'll have to try these. As you heard early in the show, I tried s'mores. S'mores goldfish, Jay, have chocolate goldfish and then like graham cracker goldfish and then marshmallow like fell out of Lucky Charms goldfish. Stars, moons, clovers. Gross.
I'm good.
Hey, I know this person who wrote in next. Lisa Solly. That's Lisa Salinger. Hi, Lisa.
I've heard of her.
She wrote in and said that it's only a matter of time before we start talking about arms, you know, that you could buy for all the digital watch things that are coming out. We have all these accessible watches coming out. That is so true. There are so many, the Bradley, you know, the Apple Watch.
Oh, gosh, the new one, the Dot.
Yep.
The Dot. We have the picture on our AT Guys Facebook of Ted Drake wearing the Beam speaker band watch next to the Apple Watch.
Yes. She calls it the iArm. Go out there and get that name. Go get it quick.
All right.
See, we have another person who said that they appreciate what they do for our community. And that's really cool. And then we have another one here. Elizabeth Bowden, who would like to thank us for doing the podcast. And it allows her to stay in touch with all the technology that's going around. She also has a tip. And it's talking about how to delete entries to find out all the ways that she recommends about how to delete entries, which I've seen going around, which is a good tip. Head on over to blindbargains.com. And Elizabeth, thank you for that. We appreciate that. And if you have a tip, you can always send it in as well, or you could record a tip and send it in to us as well. So just like the one that I did earlier in the show.
Yes. Record tips. We hear ourselves enough. So if you want to send over those, we had a lot of, app reviews and product reviews towards the beginning of our half year run. So we haven't had many of those lately. So if you want to review a product, an app, or something else, kitchen appliance, whatever, just let us know. Feedback at blindbargains.com, tweet at blindbargains, and we'll talk about it.
Changeling asks, where does Ranger Station come from? Ranger 1138 is a name that I've been using since the Pathfinder boards of the Warner Brothers entertainment days. Ranger comes from Babylon 5. 1138 comes from THX 1138. I was selling home theater at the time, and THX was my specialty, and THX 1138 is one of George Lucas's first films. Also, it makes up the THX home theater system, and so I took 1138 from there and took Ranger from Babylon 5 and kind of married the two. And then when I went to go do my blog, which is still out there, therangerstation.blogspot.com. It's a great time capsule to go back and look at. Yeah. One day, Jay has threatened me that I should write on it again. Maybe that shall happen. Ricky's asked me to do the same. Long form reading to LDR. The Ranger Station actually was a site for fans of South Park. So I couldn't go there. And so it just got kind of sort of into the Ranger Station.
Why?
And then I shortened
it to think Ranger what character Station
when
be.
I got to Twitter. Because when I went to Twitter, Rosalie, who's a forest ranger, has Ranger 1138 on Twitter. And she often and sometimes gets my tweets because somebody will write to me at Ranger 1138 and actually get this really nice Forest Ranger instead of me, which is funny. So she's learned a lot about blindness. She's a really cool person. I follow her actually and read a lot about that. So I hope that answers your question. And that's been my pseudonym for a very, very long time. And in fact, a lot of people knew me by Ranger in the industry before I started working at my former company and doing podcasting professionally, which 5 years now. So Ranger 1138 was my pseudonym when I was actually giving stories and ideas to this guy on the other side of the microphone a long time ago, him and Jeff Bishop. I was giving things to Main Menu. So yeah, that was a long, 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 crazy time ago. And that's why when you see on my little thing at the bottom that I've been doing this for like 10 years. Yeah. But I've been on the internet since like 1995 under Ranger.
TheRangerStation.com, though, at least now, the original Ultimate Forward Ranger, as in the car
resource. Okay. Wow, it changed. It used to be a South Park site. It was really cool.
I'm trying to figure out the South Park reference. Was there a
character? I don't know. I never understood that. Yeah, I don't really know where that came from, but it was a bunch of South Park characters.
Was there a Ranger? I remember the Scout. You know, there was the Scout with Big Gal and all that, but I don't know if there was anything else.
And then Jimbo and all in the beginning. You know, it's coming right for us. You know, that. But can you believe that turned 18 this year? 18 years old, South Park is.
There are people that are coming to college now that were born after South Park.
Okay.
Do you have tweets? Do you have anything else?
I also heard that Fox Media is going to stop making Simpsons DVDs. Like season 26 is the last season that you'll be able to buy.
They should have stopped making the Simpsons about 10, 15 years ago.
Well, Simpsons did it. You know, I was thinking South Park again.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, everything that they were coming up for, Simpsons did it. You know, it was like, what's in the Twitterverse?
All right. You ready? You have 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Chelsea Lynn asks, when do you guys think it's okay to update to Windows 10? Which screen readers work best? Ready? Go.
I like your answer. Episode 25 does a lot to be able to say it, but I'd still say hold on. Just hold on. It's not worth it yet. If you don't need to, don't. And NVDA's update is coming out really, really soon. I'm using it. Our RC3 beta is working. Episode 25. Episode 25. Yeah,
that was my answer, yes.
Yeah, I liked your answer. I thought that was really good. There is another Windows 10 article coming. I am working on it now. It has been 1 month almost since its release. Yeah. And so I've got a bunch of how-tos and collections and things I've been sucking up like a lint brush. So more information to come.
At Boris in a Box. I've heard of him.
Oh, yeah.
Does anyone know where to download a copy of the Keynote Gold PCMCIA DOS driver? What?
Oh, only Boris would want such a thing, and I'm shocked he did not already have it, or
right.
Freaky Food didn't have it. That
I'm surprised. I'm a little surprised that it wasn't already out there, but you know, I guess if you, meanwhile, Christopher Toth is tweeting, he's looking for basic source code. So if you wrote any basic games for the Braille and Speak,
I saw that. That's interesting.
Well, who knows?
I don't know. You know, there were games that were developed for it that were like shareware, like people would pass them around. Well,
yes, there were games, and there's two different things you have going on. There was games for the Braille and Speak that were actually .bns files, and then there were basic files that you could create. Now you could compile, you could write your own stuff if you wanted to, and then you could compile them into a .bas. Now the .bas isn't really useful anymore, but if you actually have the source code,
the type light that you played them, there's one for you. The type light.
The type light. Yeah. Hey, I wrote some. Basic back in the day. It was very clunky and it was a slow basic, but it worked. And at HP fan fiction, LOL armpit season. I've so been there. Can empathize.
Yes, it's so true. It is. I stand so up. True.
I stand up.
Well, I try to, and I try to offer my seat to others who get on the bus who I think need it more than I do. But there are some drivers who may have had, who knows, incidents or points against whatever. But there are some drivers that are very insistent in Austin. You know, sit down. Why? I could stand. Yeah.
Oh, man. Good thing I haven't encountered one of them yet, because there'd be a war. Oh, man.
Well, you know, I like to eventually get where I'm going, so, and I may have to run into that driver again, so sometimes I'm okay with it. It's like, oh, fine, I just feel
sometimes really weird about it. You just want to go to McDonald's and eat 17 Big Macs.
Sometimes the last word leaves you all sorts of stories that you might, well, you might not want to read. So if you are about to hear these stories and are more curious, remember you can head on over to blindbargains.com and read about the new world record, 17 Big Macs. Could you do this, Jay?
No. The 60, the 62 or 64 hot dog challenge that I had watched a couple months ago, I mean, that was bad.
17 Big Macs in 1 hour were consumed in order to break the world record. I don't even want to think about the aftermath of this. This is just a horrible thought. Just the thought of eating a double Big Mac actually kind of freaks me out.
If I had Hound hooked up, I could figure that out.
Yes, to find out how many calories he consumed in one sitting.
Right.
Oh, no. That's true. Yikes. I hadn't even thought of that.
It adds up. That's just the... I'm guessing it's just the Big Mac, not the whole meal. Okay, so okay, so one... I don't
even think I consume 17 of those things a year. Oh, man.
Oh, that's gosh. Just, one is $5.50, which actually isn't the worst of the McDonald's menu items. So 17 would be 9,350 calories. Well,
yeah,
that's about 5 days worth of food there. Night sure. In 1 hour.
And you could wash them all down with Pop Tart beer.
What?
Pop Tart beer.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. What flavor?
Well,
I can see that working, actually.
I'm afraid to just even ask that in a general sense.
I can see this working. I've had beer made from pie. I've had beer made from other fruits.
Sure.
I'm not Pop totally tart ruling this out.
Beer. Okay.
Depending on the flavor.
I like this challenge more than 17 Big Macs. Let me put it that way.
I will drink the Pop-Tart beer if somebody can find it for me. Sure.
Okay.
Is it available? Can you get it out?
Let me see where this link is. I bet you it's from the UK, so anything.
Yeah. Oh, of course it's in the UK. New. There's also a Count Chocula flavor.
All right.
A Pop. So, yeah, you know, I think it depends on where you are. A lot of these are very regional. The pie one was a local pie shop. Microbrew. Yep. Yeah, that's what most of these are. There's a local pie shop and a local beer company. It's called Toaster Pastry. Oh, and it's in San Francisco. Okay, it's California. Oh, right okay. Where the well, right near
it's doable. It's doable.
Tim? 21st Amendment Brewing, and that's one of the bigger ones in California. I've heard of them.
San Francisco Pastry. Lighthouse, get on it.
It's an India Red Ale. It's an homage to Pop-Tarts. It'll be released at the opening party on August 29th, so this Saturday.
Scott, I'm looking at you, Scott. Let us know how that is. That's a thing. And after that one thing that San Francisco people might not do a lot of because of their vegetarian lifestyle, or at least their forward thinking in the cases of food, especially if you've gone to CSUN and looked at the menu and looked on the back to see that it's gluten-free and all these other free and free range and everything else. Anyway, where I'm going with this is bacon. Bacon is a wonderful thing. And we've talked a little bit about bacon earlier in the show, but now, did you know that there is a way to consume bacon that has been cooked crispy in the microwave?
Yeah, because I tried it. I've tried this before.
Uh-huh.
What? And bacon in the oven works. Bacon microwave. You want to try this one?
Well, Ricky said no. I'd be curious to do so. I'll have to sit down and look at Life Hacker usually sends weird things out during the day. And this was just one that I kind of went, huh? Well, Twitter went crazy. I had this retweeted a bunch. I had a bunch of people write me about it. So I might be curious enough to try this because it just really resonated with people. This is another one of those Food Network moment things where I often get fascinated to watch somebody bake a cake in the microwave on Chopped or use it to get out of a sabotage on Cutthroat or something like that. So I'm always curious about what the microwave can do. Now, there's a lot of things you have to think of at first, which is modern microwaves work a lot better than an older microwave. And we recently got a new LG one that works really well and understands what's going on during the cooking process or has sensors inside that actually do a lot better at determining whether something has got a cold spot in the middle of it or not. And so I'm curious under this new microwave that it might be able to do this a little bit better.
A lot of them are more like convection ovens now.
Mm-hmm, agreed.
You know, they definitely have improved. I mean, there's a lot of things that you wouldn't do. You talk to your parents or people that didn't grow up with microwaves about, you know, they won't do simple things like melting butter in the microwave. I'm like,
this has a melt button. In fact, you could take your ice cream out of the freezer and hit the melt button to melt the ice cream enough to scoop it if you didn't want to wait for it to thaw.
Yeah, you can do a lot of things like that. I mean,
the potato button is the first potato button I've ever used that works correctly, which I think is really neat.
These things have got, I mean, yes, it depends a lot on the brand, but microwaves have come a long way. So, no talking ones.
Microwaves, we had that question. I actually had the Hamilton Beach talking microwave for $40. Got it out of the Walmart clearance section.
I mean, it was cheap.
Yeah. But the problem was is that it didn't have a lot of room. You weren't going to like baste a turkey in there or anything, but.
No.
Yeah, and it was very limited potato. Speech. And it had two settings. It had low and high, and they were about the same.
Good thing you backed off of the mic. One of my favorite tweets of the week before we move past the donuts and the bacon and stuff, it's like, to paraphrase, one of my favorite phrases in the world is the phrase free donuts until you put the word gluten in front of it.
So true. Oh, next week's last word won't have food in it, I promise. That's 2 weeks in a row where we've done food, so we'll do something a little different next week. But thank you for tuning in. Thank you for sending in your cards, your letters, your comments, your wonderful emails to Blind
Falcons. Your faxes, your telegrams. I really do appreciate all the
ways that your you mental projections, astral projections, if you will. All of those are accepted, depending on the ethereal plane that you reside in. You can get a hold of me, Ranger Station. You can find me at twitter.com/RangerStation or send me an email, joe@blindbargains.com. And you will find, if you follow me, you will get a lot of information, some of it that shows up on the show. But lately, a lot about retro gaming. I've been getting back into my old roots and playing around with my Sega CD and 3DO and Sega Saturn. So a lot of game music has been on my thing of late, rather than Doctor Who. Less than four weeks!
If you follow the AT Guys Twitter at AT Guys, we've been doing a lot of bargain bin type stuff as we kind of clean out the shelves and find some customer returns, open box type stuff. So you can get some stuff at a really good deal. And we've been tweeting those out. They end up there first and they go up on the website at atguys.com. But Twitter is definitely the way to see them before anybody else does. Of course, you can do the daily deals. We're about the time to rename that list because it's not just deals from Blind Bargains anymore.
This is true.
Right now, it's still called Daily Deals. The daily email scoop, if you will, from Blind Bargains. I always forget to mention that, but that's one way you can keep them up to date. And of course, at Blind Bargains on Twitter, where, by the way, whenever we do interviews and guests on, we usually put out a tweet asking people if they have questions. So if you want to kind of have a way to talk to some of our interviews as we kind of schedule them, they usually get scheduled last minute. So I can't always say the week before. But we do often ask for questions on Twitter. So if you Twitter-verse and really up on that, then you can do that at Blind Bargains. Of course, feedback at blindbargains.com as we get into the fall of 2015.
Well, that's going to do it for this week, and we appreciate you listening, and we look forward to hearing you give us feedback as we approach the big 3-0. That's right. We turn carousel with episode 30. Oh, my gosh,
30. Yeah. It's already it's getting there already. Oh, by the way, thank you to Blind Alive and Mystic Access for sponsoring us again this week. Do appreciate us, and then reach out to us if you or your company wants to sponsor us on Blind Bargains.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and see you next week.
Thanks, Patrick. Bye-bye.
This has been another Blind Bargains audio podcast. Visit blindbargains.com for the latest deals, news, and exclusive content. This podcast may not be retransmitted, sold, or reproduced without the express written permission of AT Guys.
Copyright 2015.